We are on, if you want to look in your framework books, we'll be on page like 157, 158, 159. We're not going to go through all of the Maccabean revolts, all the battles. We went through that in church, the framework study. And the details of all the maps and stuff are in there. The book of Daniel doesn't necessarily deal with those actual battles. It talks about those who are wise will instruct many. They'll receive a little help. So it indicates there's going to be a time of a rising of Jews, faithful Jews, but doesn't give the details, so we won't cover all those things. We're also in Daniel chapter 11. Daniel 11, and if you look right there, we'll be right around verse 21. And we're going to be able to get through up through verse 35, I hope, because that's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. And then beginning in verse 36, I'm going to introduce those verses that will take us to the end of the chapter. We'll talk about all those verses, but I think next week we'll come back and really cover those last verses in a little more detail. So again, Daniel chapter 11, verse 21. So I'm going to pray, and then we can go ahead and get started. Father, we come to you tonight in the name of Jesus. We do thank you for the word. We thank you for the chance to live life with the hope of Jesus Christ, the resurrection, and eternal life. We ask that we may live a life that is pleasing to you, that we'd stay focused on you, and you continue to lead and guide each one of us. Again, we thank you for the chance to look into your scriptures tonight. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, as you remember, Daniel chapter 11, as we went through this last week, we'll be looking at chapter 11, verse 2, just so you get a reference to this, begins with the Persian kings at the time of Xerxes. Three more kings will appear. In verse 2, it talks about he'll stir up the kingdom against Greece, and then a great mighty king, a hero king, which is Alexander the Great, will appear. Now you introduce the Grecian Empire, and then they split. Alexander dies. Last week I was trying to look for the verse where it says, and when the horn talks about him being cut off at the peak of his power. Well, that's earlier in the book of Daniel where it talks about the prominent horn being broken off. I was trying to find that here. Alexander dies at a very young age. And then the rest of the chapter, up until where we're at, is dealing with the king of the south and the king of the north, dealing with the Seleucid and the Ptolemy Empire. So we'll just draw a quick map here, something like this. This would be Egypt down here, Galilee, Dead Sea, Jordan River, Jerusalem, the land of Israel, of course, here. And this would be Syria up here under the control of the Seleucid kings, Syria. And this is Egypt under the rule of Ptolemy. The Ptolemy kings, I don't know if that's spelled right. It's in your notes there somewhere. These are the king of the north and the king of the south. And we talked about how they came about. There's four generals fighting against one general of Alexander's. Antigonus was defeated by Seleucid and Ptolemy, Cassander and Lysimachus, who went back home. Seleucid becomes great, and they controls this land. Ptolemy eventually takes the land of Israel from them, and they're actually battling over the land of Israel and the land of Phoenicia, right in this area here. They kind of want to control that land for tax purposes and a buffer zone for their kingdoms. And that's kind of what we've talked about. And we're not going to read through all that, but it's just back and forth discussing it up until verse 21 where we're going to begin tonight. Now, in this discussion through chapter 11, kind of a heads up so you can kind of see it coming, we are skipping large amounts of time. We began in 538 B.C., and we're going to go all the way to 160 B.C. in these verses. And it's not like every year gets addressed. It's not like every king gets addressed. Not every battle gets addressed. We're hitting blocks of time. So keep that in mind. This is in a chronological order, these events, but it's not complete history. Because there's a break coming right here that we've got to discuss, and I'll tell you what I think here at the end of the night when we get to there. Verse 36 is going to continue to talk about the king will do as he pleases. And your decision that you've got to make tonight when we get there is who is that king in verse 36? Is it a continuation of Antiochus Epiphanes? That would be what some would say. Antiochus Epiphanes is a continuation of discussion of him. Is that talking about the next empire that's coming? What is the next empire that comes after the Grecian Empire? It was Babylon. It was after that Persia, then Greece, and then Rome. John Calvin, for example, typically disappoints us in his eschatology here. He thinks the rest of the verse in chapter 11, verse 36 to the end is talking about the Roman Empire, which of course makes no sense whatsoever. That's why most Reformed people are confused today about eschatology. They're trying to figure out how they're going to deal with Calvin without just throwing him out and saying he didn't know what he's talking about eschatologically. But nonetheless, we'll move on. Or is this talking about a coming Antichrist? And that is the historical view. I mean, throughout church history, Chrysostom, Jerome, Even today, that is the predominant idea of what is being taken place right here. Is this is talking about the Antichrist in verse 36. Other ideas, I think they've mentioned Herod the Great. They're trying to figure out how Herod the Great would fulfill those verses. One interpreter or commentator tries to make Constantine the Great around 325 fit in those verses. The two main ideas are Antiochus Epiphanes, his life is continued to be discussed, or the Antichrist. And again, some options that they throw in there that aren't very popular are John Calvin's Rome, Herod the Great, or Constantine. But the point there being, we are going to take a huge leap from 160 into the future, even at an unknown date yet, in verse 36. And some people say, well, you can't take that huge jump. Well, understand, as we've been going through this entire chapter, we're doing blocks of time. So just keep that in mind as we look at that. That's kind of what we're looking at. So let's go to chapter 11, verse 21, and here we go. What has taken place is we've got the king at this time is Antiochus the third, or Antiochus the Great, and he's got a son named Seleucid the fourth, and he is going to replace him as the king. Seleucid the fourth is going to be the king. Now remember, Antiochus also has a son named Antiochus, we'll call him just A.E., Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the fourth. The Antiochus the fourth, his son, has been sent as a hostage to Rome, remember this, because Antiochus the Great from Syria decided to move west and he met Rome, the buzzsaw of Rome. Rome defeated him and says, you owe us money. And so until we get all our money from you, we'll take your son as a hostage. So remember, Antiochus Epiphanes has spent a lot of time in Rome, probably going through some kind of schooling, not just sitting chained to a wall, but going through some kind of schooling. So when Antiochus the Great, or the third, dies, His son, Seleucid the fourth, should be the king. But in the process of negotiations, they have replaced the young Seleucid, has replaced Antiochus Epiphanes, and he has returned home. And so what we've got now back in Syria, the first people to be duped or deceived is going to be the Syrian people and their government as Antiochus takes the throne. And again, keep this in mind, we're now talking about a historical person, historical events, but this reads right into the Antichrist. And so without becoming too dogmatic about it, just watch how he behaves, Antiochus Epiphanes, because this is probably a pattern of the Antichrist, the same style. Again, he's coming out of Syria. There's several reasons why we would suspect Syria to be the source of the Antichrist in the future. Not a dogmatic statement, but it's interesting. All this activity is right here. So here we begin, let's begin chapter 11, verse 20. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor, and that's what Seleucid the fourth would do. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, and not in anger or in battle. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. Now let me go back and say something different here. Antiochus dies. His son Seleucid the fourth, that I said was exchanged as a prisoner, he becomes the next king. He's got a son. And that son is sent over to Rome, and Seleucid's brother, Antiochus Epiphanes, comes back to Syria. Okay, so his son, Seleucid's son, or Antiochus' nephew, is in prison. Does that understand what I just said there? I made a mistake. And now Seleucid, when he dies, his son should become the next king, but Antiochus Epiphanes just moves into place. So somehow Seleucid dies, and then somehow Seleucid's son dies in prison, and Antiochus is the only one left. So that's what's happening here. Verse 21, he will be succeeded by a contemptible person, and that contemptible person is Antiochus Epiphanes, and that's a description both of how he treated his family, his country, and of course, how he's going to treat the Jews, who has not been given the honor of royalty. He didn't receive it, he didn't take it, he stole it, he probably murdered for the throne. He'll invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue or schemes. Now, this one, he will invade the kingdom. What kingdom is that? Is that the kingdom of Egypt, the king of the south? Is that the beautiful land Israel? I think at this point in the discussion here, he will invade the kingdom. He is invading his own kingdom. You understand? He's invading Syria. He's taking the throne. He'll invade his own kingdom, I think he means Syria, when its people feel secure, because they've got Antiochus the Great, followed by Seleucid. They've got a son, and all of a sudden, here's Antiochus Epiphanes, and all of a sudden people just start dying, and he takes it, and they're feeling secure. They're trusting the system, and pretty soon Antiochus Epiphanes, a contemptible person who shouldn't be their king, is the king. And he will seize it through intrigue or schemes, which involves paying people off in the government to support him, making promises that he can't keep, trying to convince the same thing he's going to try to do to the Jews down here, of paying people off and making promises and negotiating of things he cannot keep or has no intention of keeping. It says, then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and the prince of the covenant will be destroyed. Now what takes place in verse 22 here is now he's talking about probably the Egyptian Empire, the king of the south. And there's going to be a couple things happen here. We talked about last week about the Syrian wars, the six Syrian wars of going back and forth. We can continue to call them the fifth and sixth Syrian wars if you want to, but we'll call them tonight just the Egyptian War number one and the Egyptian War number two. And this first Egyptian war, it is right here, when he secures here, he's going to come down and he's going to attack Egypt. He's going to attack Ptolemy, who himself is going to be a very, very young person, and he's got advisors that are leading him. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away, which is the Egyptian army. Both it and the prince of the covenant will be destroyed. And the prince of the covenant is probably the young Ptolemy, who is going to be making an agreement or a treaty. At the end, Ptolemy and Antiochus Epiphanes will make an agreement and say make promises to each other on this covenant. And that covenant right there, I have thought before that could be Onias III, who, when we look at Israel, has been removed. He was the high priest. Now I'm telling you so many things here. Onias III was the great priest, high priest here in Jerusalem, and he resisted Antiochus Epiphanes and was taken up to Syria. And when he complains and disagrees with some of the political moves Antiochus is making, Onias is then executed. So that could be the prince of the covenant as the covenant of Moses. Or else it could be the prince Ptolemy, who is the king, who helps agree with this covenant but is going to break all of the covenant. So nonetheless, verse 23, after coming to an agreement with him, that's why I'm starting to think it's Ptolemy who made the agreement, after coming to an agreement with him, the new Ptolemy, he will act deceitfully, Antiochus Epiphanes. So if we stay with the idea here that this covenant is between Egypt and Ptolemy, after the defeat of Egypt, Antiochus Epiphanes makes an agreement with Ptolemy and lies to him, basically. And it says right here, after coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully. He makes a treaty, and as soon as he makes a treaty, what does he do? He breaks the treaty. So he's deceived his people. Well, he's deceived his family. He's deceived his people or his country, and now he's made an agreement with Egypt and broken that treaty. So he's a liar. He's a deceiver. And with only a few people, he will rise to power. We're still talking about the fact that Antiochus Epiphanes is rising to power with only a few people supporting him, a bunch of them getting bought off. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot an overthrow. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. And again, he still has this debt remaining that his father built up, having to pay Rome back. So he continues to lie to different nations, different groups of people. And then once they feel secure, he invades them, robs the temple, and helps pay this debt back to Rome. He is in fear of Rome. But again, he is making covenants and treaties all the way through this. Verse 25. This would now be the year 170 B.C., which would be the fifth Syrian war. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. This would be Ptolemy the VI, if you're keeping track. The king of the south, Ptolemy the VI, will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because the plots devised against him. One of the things, remember the treaty, and we'd say he's a deceiver, one of the things Antiochus Epiphanes is doing is Ptolemy the VI is trying to defend his country. He's already been lied to by Antiochus Epiphanes, and finally Ptolemy is going to try and come up and defeat him and have a war with him, but Antiochus Epiphanes is actually manipulating people down here in Egypt to undermine Ptolemy the king, including his brother. And so, again, let's read this again, what it says right here. A march out of the large army, the king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army against Antiochus Epiphanes, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against them. Where are those plots? Well, clearly they're coming from Syria, but that's who he's fighting with. The plots that we're talking about here are back home. The deceit that's taking place back here, he can't trust anybody because they're on the pay list of Antiochus Epiphanes. The two kings, Ptolemy and Antiochus Epiphanes, with their hearts bent on evil, both of them, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. Now, if you wonder about Middle Eastern peace treaties right now and negotiations, again, I don't want to be negative about it or anything, but when these two groups sit down and talk to each other, I mean, how much of it is actually, you know, going to take place? I mean, they're making agreements and then they'll break the agreements. Now, notice this is the second time it says right here, because the end will still come at the appointed time, and it's mentioned here up here just a little bit further at the end of verse 24, but only for a time. In other words, the Jews, as these things are unraveling, the Jews are being told an appointed time, but only for a time. The ideal is that this is a short period of time, and this is a controlled period of time. That this king, Antiochus Epiphanes, as like the Antichrist, is going to have certain powers that are going to be unleashed to him, but there's a limit, there's a boundary, there's a set time, it's going to be a short time. And so he is not in control. He is just moving within the parameters that God has given him. Now, we will ask why, again, all this is being, why do we care about Syria and Egypt? Because this is all building up for this big event right here in Egypt of where there's going to be great persecution in Egypt, or excuse me, in Israel. And we'd ask, why would God call this short and controlled? And we're going to have one time, we're going to have like 85,000 people killed on Antiochus' first attack on Jerusalem. There's going to be tens of thousands of people killed afterwards. Why is why is the angel so confident that it's only for a time, that only as long as he's allowed to? Why are these things being done? Again, it's a harsh question. We would call it very evil. Why does God allow evil to happen? I mean, this is a typical philosophical question. How can there be a God and evil takes place? I believe the answer in this situation, not in every situation, in this situation is going to be told to us as we get later on here in chapter 11, and basically it's going to be a purification of his people. Because this is these events are going to end up right around 160, and within 160 years, you know, right around 4 BC, we'll say, Jesus Christ, the greatest event in history, is going to begin to take place right here in Jerusalem. And these people, the culture has to be such that they can receive the message and spread it around the world for the beginning of the church age and the promotion of the gospel. So in other words, this is, no matter how you look at it, one, it is a purification of Israel. It is a refining of Israel in preparation for this event of the coming of the Messiah. That's clearly one way of looking at it. The other thing we can see along this, we talked about this at Bible school, is many of these Jews, when Antiochus Epiphanes comes down here and starts to persecute them and say, turn away from Judaism, turn towards Hellenism, and he starts making the promises and the lies and the deceit and bringing them money and giving them gifts, many of the Jews will say, what a great idea, and they will quickly forsake the covenant that Moses gave them. So now it becomes not just purification, but judgment. A lot of these things that are going to take place right here are going to be judgment for the Jews who collapsed under the simple pressure of just being offered some material possessions and some imperial favors, and they turn their back on God. Now, not all the Jews are going to do that, and those who stand their ground, the Bible's going to say, they'll be purified. So in other words, number one, this is going to be a time of judgment for Israel because they've forsaken the covenant and went with Antiochus Epiphanes, and those who stood firm, it's going to be a time of purification in preparation, well, for their own lives, but a purification of the nation for the coming of the Messiah. And look at this. What a crazy chapter. I mean, you can read this chapter. I mean, you'd say, wow, this is so amazing. Look how precise the prophecy is. And Galen's reading through the king of the south, the king of the north. It's, oh, wow, this is so amazing. But it's like, why? Who really cares? And this is one reason why a lot of people don't even know these chapters are here. Who would care about this? Well, and the reason this is important is because of this reason right here. The Jews are being told, you're going into a period of refining and a period of judgment, but it's going to be short and it's going to be under control, so stay focused. When these things, you know, and we've all been in some situations where it was bad or disastrous, you know, like, you know, anything, you know, terrifying in my life, maybe, you know, a bad job where I had to work, you know, a lot of hours or something, you know, but, you know, you can get in a situation where it's like, this is never going to end. Life is just so terrible. It just goes on and on forever. But it's like, no, it's controlled and it's short. And in this case, it's going to be terrifying. 85,000 people dying in one invasion. they can understand, they can begin thinking, we're going to get wiped out. It's over. This is never going to end. But the same prophecy that told them when they were this was coming tells them it's under control and it's short. So we are in verse 27. The two kings, Ptolemy and Antiochus Epiphanes, with their hearts bent on evil against each other, will sit at the same table, a negotiation, and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. Now, this end, you can think about it, it could be the end of time, you know, the return of the Lord, or it could be the end of this subject that we're talking about. I tend to think that at this point in the discussion, the end right now is the suffering that is going to be unleashed because of Antiochus Epiphanes. This end will come at the appointed time. Verse 28, the king of the north, Antiochus Epiphanes the fourth, will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. So after negotiating this, the king of the north, Antiochus Epiphanes, returns. He's very powerful. He's very wealthy. He looks like he is really rocking the world. Things are coming together for him. And now he says there's one thing we need to do. We need to secure this land. And there's something in this land that is holding the people back. It is the covenant of Moses. It involves the circumcision. It involves the scriptures. It involves the holy days. It involves their entire lifestyle. We've got to get rid of that holy covenant, get these people away from this book, this law, this covenant, and get them into our party here, because he needs them not to be with Egypt, but he needs them to be with him. And do realize many, many people in Israel like Egypt. Some of them are tax collectors. They work for Ptolemy. They work for the king collecting taxes. Some people in Israel are making money because of Ptolemy, because of the Egyptians. So Antiochus wants them now to think like he thinks, so they'll be more resistant because he cannot have a control over them with Israel also being on their side, or at least it's going to be more difficult. So he's going to come against the Holy Covenant. Now, what I just told you would be a practical reason for coming against the Holy Covenant. But now, on a more spiritual level, Satan really doesn't care what the political reason is. We want to get rid of that covenant. We want to get rid of these people. And so you've got Ptolemy acting one way for political strategy. He's not really saying, I'm an evil man, I want to undo the covenant. He wants them probably for political reasons. Satan's behind it saying, we've got to undermine this whole thing and destroy the covenant so I can control and work my plan. God is behind that saying, fine, this will be a great time of judging the Jews who aren't faithful and purifying the faithful so we'll be stronger on the other side. So you've got the political layer, you've got the evil layer, and then you've got the layer of God watching the whole thing, purifying his people, which is I mean, that's really a lot about what life is like. People are doing things that are evil, and they say, why are they so evil? They're not. They're just political. It's just now a convenient opportunity for them to get ahead. Behind them is Satan doing something probably what we'd say is the evil, but the people sometimes don't even realize. That's when you say, that's evil, you go, it's just my advantage. But then why did God allow it to happen? Because God's working the master plan behind the whole thing, which sometimes is kind of scary. It's like, why does God allow that? Well, because he tells us we live by faith, not by sight. The same thing he told Job, same thing he told many people, Habakkuk. We are going to live by faith. We're going to trust him, knowing that he's working the plan. The time is short, and it is under control, so just keep marching ahead. Verse 28, the king of the north will return to his own country, Antiochus Epiphanes, with great wealth, meaning he's now secured himself, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, probably for political reasons. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. So that would be right around the year 169. And then verse 29 would be 168, right here where it says, at the appointed time, that is 168. Notice here again, at the appointed time. God is letting this thing happen, and then Antiochus Epiphanes becomes powerful, becomes wealthy. He begins to persecute the Holy Covenant, but now it's like, okay, I'm happy. God says, no, you're not. You need to move on to the next level. We need to go to the next level of this game. And at the appointed time in 168 BC, he will invade the south again. But this time, the outcome will be different from what it was before. The last time he came down there, he conquered, he negotiated, lied, was deceitful, came away with great wealth, and began to persecute the Jews in Israel. I got an awful big Mediterranean Sea there. I don't need that much water on my board. Okay, maybe a little more shallow. Okay, Egypt, Syria. Okay, now, coming from the west, here we go. In 168, which would now be in a sense, the second war with Egypt that's recorded in this. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different. The last time the outcome was great victory for Antiochus Epiphanes. This time it's going to be opposite from what it was before. Ships from the western coastlands. Now, if you look down in your, if you got like little footnotes in your Bible, you know, or in the from the text, it says this word is the word Kittim, K-I-T-T-I-M, which is the word for this island called Cyprus right here. That's the word for it, Cyprus. And so it looks like ships come from Cyprus, which doesn't make any sense at all. And so what that means, and NIV's translated it correctly. Now, here's an example. Are you ready? Here's an example, maybe, of the two types of translation, word for word and thought for thought. When it says right here in the text, it says Kittim. Kittim means Cyprus. So if you were to read this, it says the outcome will be different. Ships from Cyprus will oppose him. Well, it's like, now you're lost. Like, what does that mean? The word Cyprus, it does refer to this, but the word Cyprus in the writings of this time, and not just here, but in other writings, referred to not just Cyprus, but to all of the land of the Mediterranean. So any country of the Mediterranean would be Kittim. And so it's from Egypt, it's west, and that's why it would say right here, it's now you're not translating word for word in the NIV, you're translating thought for thought. What does Kittim, what is he trying to say? They're trying to say the western coastlands. Now, do you understand what just took place right there? I mean, people say, I want a word-for-word translation. Of course, we believe in word-for-word translation because the power is in the word. But the words contain meanings and thoughts. And if you just translate a word for the word's sake and you lose the actual intention of why that word was used, the meaning of the time or how it was supposed to be understood, if you lose that, all you've got is, a 5 or 6-letter word that makes no sense. So again, the NIV goes with a thought for thought here because it says this is what they're trying to say from the western coastlands. And that's important to kind of understand. Now, what is the problem with the thought for thought is there may be 2 or 3 thoughts that could be meant by that word. And now the writer or the translators have to decide which one were they talking about. And if you choose the wrong thought, now you're still lost. You've still confused people. I think this is pretty simple right here. This is not even a controversial thing. Does anybody have anything really different there in verse 30 in a different translation? Okay. Ships from the western coastlands will oppose him and he will lose heart. And so what takes place here, the Romans have been called, they're actually in Alexandria, Egypt, and Antiochus Epiphanes is marching towards Alexandria, Egypt. He is 4 miles from Alexandria, Egypt, according to the historical account. But Ptolemy has called his friends, the Romans, and says, we're going to need help because he's already defeated us once. If he gets here a second time, we're going to fall. And Rome got their grain from Egypt. And so Rome is going to come down and defend Ptolemy and Egypt to protect their source of grain and deal with Antiochus Epiphanes. And you've heard me talk about this before. And so when he gets down there, he's 4 miles away. Linnaeus is the emperor general's name, meets him 4 miles outside of Alexandria and it draws a circle around him, draws a circle around him and says, you decide what you're going to do. Are you going to retreat or are you going to fight? And Antiochus Epiphanes says, well, I want time to think about it. He says, okay. And that's when he drew the circle around him and says, okay, you decide. Before you step out of that circle, I'll give you all the time you want inside that circle. And so now Antiochus Epiphanes, having been in Rome, he's been in Rome, he's seen Rome. His father was defeated by Rome and he's still trying to pay him back. And now Rome is standing here with their arsenals pointed right at him. Antiochus Epiphanes realizes, there's no way he can fight this battle. He's seen it, he's experienced the payment back, and he's staring him in the face. And so he humiliates himself and says, we're retreating. He was forced to say that. But now he's embarrassed, he's humiliated. And then in the rest of verse 30, then he'll turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And so now again, why? Because he was defeated, was all of a sudden he hates God even more. I mean, you can play that card. Maybe now he's just angry at God, but I don't even think he recognizes the God of Israel. He's got the Roman pantheon or the Grecian pantheon. He's got all his own gods. So he's not looking and saying it's God of Israel's fault. Again, this is probably political. I've got to get this established, and I've got to get it established now. So he turns back and goes back into Jerusalem and begins the Jewish persecution. And this is the persecution. Well, let's just read here. He will return to show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Guys like Menelaus. Remember Menelaus? He was a Jewish person who bought the priesthood. We'll go back a little bit. Antiochus Epiphanes. When the high priest was Onias, Jason went up to pay tribute, but decided his name was Joshua, Hebrew name. When he was there, Joshua decides, I'll give Antiochus Epiphanes money if you'll make me the high priest. So Onias was removed, and Joshua changed his name to Jason, and Jason is now the high priest and opens the temple up. He sends Menelaus up with the tribute, and Menelaus says, I'll give you even more money than Jason. Menelaus returns with a military, and Jason is driven away. Jason's tomb is still in Israel today. They found it. And Menelaus, now this is a Jew, becomes now the high priest and is in position to open the temple up to Antiochus Epiphanes. And we've talked about that before, but we'll say it again. If Antiochus Epiphanes is a type of the Antichrist, then Jason and Menelaus are a type of the false prophet. And you can do whatever you want. You're reading Revelation about the beast of the sea and the beast from the earth and the false prophet. But they're basically in a Jew, in this case, who has access to the temple and opens the temple up, and the Antichrist or Antichrist Epiphanes begins to use it for his own advantage, his own political advantage here. So anyway, Menelaus would be one of those right here where it says, he'll return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Now, this would be the time of testing or the time of judging. Are you going to forsake the covenant so that you can have favor with Antiochus Epiphanes? Or are you going to stand firm? There's a verse here I wanted to... Is it coming up? There's two verses. Oh, it's coming up in verse 32. Yes, it's coming. Here you go. I'll just keep reading. His armed force will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifices. This is going to take place on, they're going to set up the image, or set it up on, here's a date, it's in December of 167. It would be early in December. They'll set up the image. It's going to be an image of Zeus, Jupiter. It's going to be an idol, but it also serves as an altar. So it's like a combination of idol, altar. So you can offer sacrifice on it, but the idol itself is attached to it, of Zeus or Jupiter, which is, keeps this in mind, that is Antiochus, that's the god of his choice. That's the head of his pantheon. He sets it up in early December of 167, and by December 15th, 167, they begin offering sacrifices on it. In other words, they burn pig meat on that altar in the temple of Israel, in Jerusalem, on the Temple Mount, and of course desecrates the temple. So that's what we're reading right here. Verse 31, his armed force will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress. Now, again, it's the Temple Mount or the temple, but it's called the Temple Fortress. And now this takes that whole Temple Mount that we look at today and makes it even more interesting. I'm going to try to draw something here very quickly for you. Again, this is the city of David right here, the Kidron Valley, the Hinnom Valley coming around like this. Right up here was, you know, it was continuing a rising ridge, and up here was where Mount Moriah would be located, right up in here. This would be the Temple Mount. The temple would be built right here. It served as a fortress. It was sometimes, especially at this time, the Seleucid would move in there and they'd set up their military. They ended up, let me bring this down a little bit more here. They ended up building a actual fortress right here called the Acra, which means fortress. Now, when we went through this during Bible school framework, I was kept talking about Fort Antoni, which was located right here, kept pointing at this location because I kind of thought that's where it was, you know. But it is now that I've been over there again and did some more work and reading and stuff and actually saw the remains of Fort Antoni. We can talk about that later. But you can see this was actually built a fortress right here to overlook the temple. And you can still see it's not like, oh, look, it's really clear. But they've excavated it, and because they tell you that's what it is, you know that's what it is. But you can see the remains of this temple fortress, or the Acra, which was built right here to overlook the operation of the temple by the Jews. When the Hasmoneans, or the Maccabees, take control, they're going to extend the Temple Mount this way a little ways and actually build over the top of the Acra, or the fortress that the Seleucids hid in for like 10 years, and cover up this part right here that you cannot see any longer. This part right here is still observable. Herod added onto it some more too, but you can still see part of the Acra sticking out there underneath. So this would be Zerubbabel's temple. The Hasmoneans add on to the Temple Mount. Then the temple's still right here. And then Herod adds on to the Temple Mount even more. We'll talk about that when I get the book out and we'll look at some pictures. But nonetheless, that is what they call the Temple. It's just interesting that all this is going on. And the text calls it in 539 B.C., looking into the future, doesn't call it the Temple or the Temple Mount. They call it the Temple Fortress because that is what it became. It became the center of military action. I mentioned this too. After the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., the 10th Roman Legion camped over here on the west side of Jerusalem for a while, but in 135, when the Jews tried to rebuild the temple and some things took place there, the Roman Legion, the 10th Roman Legion, just built their camp right there on the Temple Mount, and this became the operation of the Romans right there on the Temple Mount, another fortress location. Okay, let's go back to this. His armed forces, verse 31, his armed forces, Antiochus Epiphanes, will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. They will kill people who have scrolls. If they're found with the scriptures, they will be killed. If they offer sacrifices, they will obviously be killed. Of course, they can't because it's defiled. They wouldn't do it anyhow. Circumcision is forbidden. If your children are circumcised, they'll be death. And just keep this in mind. Antiochus Epiphanes is trying to stamp out the covenant. And he tries to do away with the scrolls or the scriptures, tries to do away with circumcision, tries to do away with the feast days. But now remember, circumcision. And we talked about this a little bit a couple weeks ago in Bible study on Monday night in Framework. Is now you understand again the difficulty for Paul and the Galatians and the book of Galatians when all of a sudden Paul was saying there's no need for circumcision for the Gentiles. And it's very easy to see how these Jews who had fought and many of their family members had lost their lives because of Antiochus Epiphanes trying to prevent circumcision, and they continue to do it even in the face of persecution. Now comes the Apostle Paul in the New Testament. It's not a big deal. Just let it go if you're a Gentile. And you can see how they would want to resist it because it's like, this is just Antiochus Epiphanes coming at us from a different direction. It's the same result, in a sense, but from a different angle. You see why the Jews were a little bit hesitant to agree with Paul. Although, again, I'll say this. Paul was telling them that the Gentiles didn't need to be circumcised for salvation. But he wasn't really telling them, the Jews, you should stop circumcising. I mean, go ahead, you know, it's like, that's your culture, do it. But it's not part of the salvation message. Antiochus Epiphanes was trying to get the Jews to stop circumcising altogether and all the other rituals. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation, December of 167, with flattery, and here it is, flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. Those who are willing to violate, notice they already have violated the covenant, and if they're willing to violate the covenant, he's going to flatter them, and that would mean not just saying, oh, I like your hair today, and like, wow, you know, did a great job at the game last night. Not just flattery, but telling them things they want to hear. What would that mean? That'd be like political promises. Just flatter, not just flattering and say, what a great person you are, but telling them things they want to hear to get them to do what he wants. In other words, lying to them with political promises, promising them change or something like this. With flattery, he'll corrupt those who have violated the covenant. Now, they violated the covenant, and now he's going to lie to them, and they're going to believe it. Notice they've walked away from the truth, and now they'll believe a lie. Paul says the same thing in Thessalonians. Those in the end times, those who have rejected the truth will be flattered with a lie that they will believe. Now, if you watch this, but what happens if you hold to the truth? Well, here it comes. But the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Now, I'll tell you what, this is, if you ask me again, you know, again, I may be wrong, but if you were to, what is my purpose? What am I doing with Generation Word? That I'm doing this right here. The people who know their God will firmly resist him. We're in the middle of Iowa. We're just doing our thing. It's like there's no problem. Everything's happy. You know, great. Just got back from cross-country race. Going to go home and have a good night's sleep. The world's just... What we are doing is we are preparing people, telling them who their God is, so when those deceptions come, they can process them. We're planting seeds. You see what I'm saying? I mean, we are planting seeds in people's lives so that they will hear the truth, they'll know the truth, and they will say things like, and you'll hear it, sometimes I even wonder it myself, why do we need to know this? When will this ever be important? How can we use this? But that's just like a farmer going out in the spring saying, why do we need to plant these seeds? We plant them and nothing's even happening. I'm just wasting my time plowing up and down, planting seeds up and down, and then I go to bed, I come back, plant more seeds, get up, there's nothing here, and now I've got to go. My wife says, go plant more seeds. It's like, why are we, what a waste, do we need these seeds? not today, but there's a day coming when all of a sudden you're going to have a crop and they're not. And that is what this verse is right about right here. With flattery, he will corrupt those. He will tell them things that aren't true, but they want to hear. He'll corrupt those who have violated the covenant, who don't know their God. They've already walked away. They didn't plant any seeds. They skipped Bible study. They didn't go to church, or they went to a church that showed videotapes or something. And now, here comes the lie. It's kind of like, well, they can't even process it. They just believe it. That's a nice thing. What a great promise. It's going to be just like he said. But though the people who know their God will firmly resist him. They just won't say, well, I don't know if that's true or not. That's not what we believe. They will dig their heels in and resist him and says, no, we know what this is. This is the lie. And that is what's taking place right here. This culture in Israel at this time is now being divided. And really, if you want to know why have we read all this, why is the angel telling him all this, is he's telling Daniel, this is where your people are marching to. They're marching to this point right here. And some people are not going to be ready. He's going to flatter them. They're going to go, okay, and they're going to follow him. And others are going to say, well, we've been listening to the Bible teaching in the synagogue. We've been training our kids. We've been waiting for the Messiah. And it's like it doesn't seem to really matter. Everybody's the same. Everybody's got the same job. Everybody's happy. Those who believe, those who don't believe, those who study, those who don't study, everybody's the same. But right here, there's your dividing point. Things are going to now, people are going to start going the two ways. Remember, we talked about that before, and nothing new. There's two paths. There's two ways of building your house. There's two types of trees. There's life, there's death, there's blessing. It's like, yeah, but sometimes in our American life, it seems like everybody's just going right down here. It's like, what's the difference? Habakkuk asks the same question. There's no difference between the righteous and the unrighteous. Everybody's just right here. Those who have Bible study and those who don't have a clue, they're just right here. But the day is coming where it's going to V off, and those who are on the narrow path will go, and those who are on the wide, broad path, you'll begin to see that separation. And when's that going to come? Well, of course, it comes at different times in your own life all the time. But I think we are preparing people for that right now. It's like, what a waste of time. What a waste of time. Well, yeah, it seems that same way in the spring when you're planting crops. You go out and look at it, nothing happens. Nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. I think it is. I think we're planting seeds. And it's going to come up here again. Watch this. Verse 33, right on the tails of that. At that time, those who are, well, now I added that at that time, but just continuing. It's got, with flattery, Antiochus Epiphanes will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. The next verse, those who are wise, which literally says this. It says, those who cause to be wise. When NIV says, those who are wise, literally says, those who cause to be wise. Well, who would be a person that would cause to be wise? We call them a teacher, okay? And there's two ways of looking at this. As you can look at it, if those who are wise, those who possess wisdom would be what they're talking about, or those who cause to be wise, which would be the literal translation, which would be the teachers, and look at this next line, will instruct, you know, okay, well, that would make sense. Those who cause to be wise, the teachers, will instruct, and instruct is literally give understanding. So right now, literally what this would say, those who cause to be wise will give understanding. And the next word is many in the NIV, many, but literally it means, it says the many, which is a word for a reference to Israel. So in other words, those who cause wisdom, those who cause to be wise will give understanding to the Jews or Israel. Though for a little time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered, those who become wise, who hear the teaching, the many, the Jews, who embrace this teaching, it says, but for a while, what's going to happen? Well, they're going to fall by the sword, be burned, captured, or plundered. It's like, well, what's that saying? Well, what that's called, the testing. You've heard the truth, and now, I'm sorry, this is just kind of the way God has done things. There's going to be now the testing of the seed. Are you in on this? And so now you're going to have a testing. And now this is during the times of the right before the Maccabean revolt, you know, 168, you know, 169. Many are hearing the wisdom. Those who are wise are instructing. The wisdom is spreading. They're being more convinced by it. No deliverance is coming. But then it goes on and says, verse 34, when they fall, those who are wise, say the teachers, and those who have received the instruction and are living it, when they fall, they will receive a little help. Now, I think this is the Maccabean revolt. They will receive a little help. And many who are not sincere will join them. And now I know it's the Maccabean revolt. Because when the Maccabeans began, it was Mattathias at Modena. Again, you've got all the maps and details in the framework book, or enough to kind of make your way through it. In a rural village outside of Jerusalem in the hills of Judea, a priestly family, they'd been trained as priests. They knew how to sacrifice animals. They knew how to use a knife, thank God. And they're out here in the wilderness of Modin. In fact, if you land in Tel Aviv and you drive into Jerusalem, you drive right by Modin. It says Modin. It's still there today. It says the tombs of the Maccabees. You drive. First thing I saw, I went to Israel the first time. Oh, there it was. And the people in the cheroot there, they said, first time in Israel? It's like, we drive by that every day. It's like, yeah, from Iowa, we don't have the Modin there. But anyway, in Modin, it's a hill country in the middle of nowhere. Mattathias, he had five sons. Judas was one of them. Eleazar, he ended up getting crushed by an elephant. Jonathan become one of the high priests, and there's two other ones. I'm trying to think. Simon was another one, but I can't remember the fifth one's name. Anyway, you know the story very quickly. Antiochus Epiphanes is sending out detachments of soldiers, and they're going out. They're bringing the little altar, the little totem pole. They're bringing a little pig, and everybody's supposed to, in the community, just have one of the leaders, maybe a priest, one of the leaders, those who they can manipulate with flattery, those who forsake the covenant already, just come forward, offer the pig, and we'll move to the next village. They're just marching through the villages just like that. Many are being flattered. Many have forsaken the covenant. Israel is just falling village after village. They come to Modin. Mattathias, the old priest, they say, will you do it? He says, no, I'm not. He may have been 100 years old, they say. But a man in the community who was an apostate Jew says, I'll do it. Step forward to take the sacrificial knife, which for the Greeks was actually a hatchet. Reaches for it. Mattathias jumps forward, grabs the thing, and sticks it in the guy's chest. His five sons pull out their sacrificial knives. They're used to carving up animals, but they can carve up people too. And they just take out that group, that battalion of soldiers. They're dead. Just instantly, that's the Maccabean revolt right there. And they realize we're in trouble. Because this is the solution, this Syrian Empire, who's messing with Egypt. The only reason Egypt's being delivered is because Rome is protecting them. And now, this empire is after them. So they go hide in the hill country of Judea, and they begin some night invasions. They go down and invade different villages and convince people to follow the law of Moses. They circumcise children that haven't been circumcised. They find Jewish children that haven't been circumcised. They circumcise them. And, of course, they send out divisions of soldiers different times. There's like several battles. And by the time the Maccabean revolt is done, they have established an independent nation of Israel who actually goes over to Rome and negotiates a treaty with Rome, the Maccabees. They become known then as the Hasmoneans. Maccabees comes from the name the Hammer, because they struck with such force, they're called the Hammer, which is almost like a nickname. But their priestly family actually comes from Hasmon. And so that would be like Mattathias' great-great-great-great-grandfather was Hasmon. And so they became known as the Hasmoneans, because that was their priestly family name. And so whenever you're reading the Bible or reading history, the Hasmoneans, they become here. Now, here's what happens. As they begin to grow and spread, I mean, they're in a village, but they begin to grow and spread. Now, do you understand this verse right here? Verse 34, when the wise and those that are learning and are sticking with the covenant, they'll die by the sword, be burned, be captured, be plundered. Verse 34, when they fall, they'll receive a little help, the Maccabean revolt. And here, understand this, and many who are not sincere will join them. Do you understand what that means? That means all these apostates who are being, in a sense, judged or tested, and they're really on the side of the Ptolemies, now they're on the side of the Seleucids, they've forsaken the covenant, but it's kind of like, oh, the political winds have changed. Whoa, we're with you. And now it's just like what happened with Constantine. When Constantine became emperor and made Christianity legal, well, everybody's a Christian, you know. And that's one thing. The diluting process. Up until that time, it was a pure movement of God. They're facing opposition. You're either in or you're out. What's it going to be? You may die if you're in. Well, pretty soon they control this whole area, and now it's on everybody's in. It's like, and now the whole movement got diluted. And the sons that came from the Hasmoneans, they became kings and high priests and generals. So they actually became the king, the priest, and the general of Israel, and that is caused, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. The Hasmonean time period was one of the most corrupt periods in Jewish history, between, let's say, 135 up until the time that Herod came, let's say, right around 40 B.C., and again, we can study that time period. Thank God for Herod. If Herod hadn't shown up, the Jews would have destroyed themselves. I know Herod's the bad guy, but if you read history, he came in and he held the thing together. But nonetheless, the has on the ends become very corrupt. And that's kind of what this is saying right here. They'll receive a little help, the Maccabean revolt, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless. Now, these words, refined, purified, and spotless, that sounds great, but what does it mean? Here's what they mean right here. The word refine means to fuse and cast. Like when you set something, when you pour like liquid metal into a mold, you cast it into a shape. And that's what's happening. The process of life is it's casting them into the image. Who are you? That's what's happening to your life right now. Everything that happens to you, you're being molded into who you are. And what's in your heart is coming out into this mold. That's what life is doing to you. Okay, this is who you are. Purified means examine. It means to be tested. They're going to be put in situations. Their image is going to be cast through situations. They're going to be examined through these fiery trials and made spotless. That means cleansed. That means God is going to see what's in your heart. He's going to examine it. And what's wrong, he's going to make it spotless. He's going to go after it and purify it and make it pure. Until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. So you see right here, what's this all about? Really, I think if you want to know what this is about, it's about those verses right here. People are going to be refined during this process. Oh, those who are not sincere are going to be exposed. Those who are sincere, they're eventually going to have enough. And they're going to stick the hatchet in the chest of the apostate. I'm not talking about violence here by the Tea Party or something. But they're going to cause a reaction in the land that's going to continue until the end. And in the process, they're going to have a little success, but the problem there is going to be they're going to continue to fall. But the reason for that is not because they're being disobedient or God's not watching. God is forming them into a people he can use. Okay, that is what we've got so far. Now I'm going to begin. What time is it getting to be? Okay, it may work out perfect. What we've read here in chapter 11 so far, chapter 11, verse 1 through 35, I can say fairly confidently, universally, everybody agrees with the time period. Now, they may have some different kings may be moved different or different events, like the Prince of the Covenant, who that is, maybe someone different in history, but it basically covers Persia, Greece, the division of the Grecian Empire. This is definitely Antiochus Epiphanes. Very few people would say anything different, I mean, from any group. They will question the integrity of these verses. Like they'll say, well, these weren't written until 160. These were actually written by the Maccabees during these events to try to motivate people. What a great thing to do, to lie about God's word to motivate people to serve God that you're lying about. It's like, well, okay. But nonetheless, they still say that's what this is talking about. So that's, I will say, universal. But now verse 36 is where we deviate. And this is where you're going to have to make a choice. I'm going to give you some ideas here. Number one, let me just read these verses quick. Chapter 11, verse 36. Now, you've kind of followed what we've been saying so far. Now, just keep this in mind. Let's stay in the period of the Maccabees. But it kind of sounds like that closed down, doesn't it? I mean, it kind of closed down in the time of the end. They're purified. It kind of like that was the purpose. I mean, it's almost like that's the end of that story. But just for your own entertainment pleasure, just pretend the king, verse 36, the king, that's Antiochus Epiphanes. Or if you really love John Calvin, let's pretend that's the Roman emperor. Okay, John Calvin thinks that, and I see what he can do with it here. But who is this talking about? Here we go, I'm going to read it. The king will do as he pleases. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes did. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god. Well, he didn't. He brought Zeus in and said, Zeus is God. And will say unheard of things against the God of gods. Well, he tried to destroy the covenant. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, okay? For what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers. Now, did Antiochus Epiphanes show regard for the God of his fathers? I mean, he set up Zeus, Jupiter, in the temple. I mean, this is the Greek gods. Or for the one desired by women. Okay, we'll have to talk about that. Nor will he regard any god. Did Antiochus Epiphanes regard any god? I mean, the Greek gods, definitely. But will exalt himself above them all. Well, he didn't say he was above the gods. He brought in gods. Instead of them, he'll honor a god of fortress, a god unknown to his fathers, a god unknown to his fathers again. I mean, did his fathers know the gods that he worshipped? Exactly did. And he'll honor the gold of with gold and silver. Now again, even stick, you know, just for the sake, John Calvin, does this make sense? Is this Rome? What did Rome do? Rome adopted or adapted the cultures they overcame. And who were the Roman gods? The Greek gods with new names. I mean, they just take it and bring it in. They worship the Greek gods. So this is, you know, isn't Rome, but I don't want to criticize Calvin. Verse 39, he'll attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god, interesting, and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. Okay, well, Antiochus Epiphanes did that. You acknowledge me, we'll honor you. But really, it was more about flattery. Here they're acknowledging him, but here we go. He will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the land at a price. Now, there's no record of Antiochus Epiphanes taking the land of Israel and dividing it up and giving it to different people who are willing to pay for it or serve him. Verse 40, at the time of the end, okay, here's the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle. Well, that'd be Ptolemy, I guess, or one of the Ptolemies, maybe Cleopatra. And the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots. Ooh, wait, if this is, isn't Antiochus Epiphanes the king of the north? It's like, it can't be Antiochus Epiphanes because he's now invading himself. Or maybe not. And cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He'll invade many countries, sweep through them like a flood. He'll also invade the beautiful land, which is Israel, and he did. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and the riches of Egypt with the Libyans and Nubians in submission. This would be on the northern coast of Africa. Antiochus Epiphanes never got past Alexandria. You know, because Antiochus Epiphanes, he's going to die in, what is the year he dies in? It's like 160. But he's going to go to Persia, invading a temple, 163. Antiochus Epiphanes dies in 163, and he's in Persia raiding a temple. They say he's insane at this time, and he dies a miserable death, and he's gone. So none of these things are fulfilled by him. But anyway, controls the northern coast of Africa. He will extend the power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He'll gain control of the treasures of gold, of silver, and riches of Egypt with the Libyans and Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he'll set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain, between the seas, that's the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, at the beautiful holy mountain, which is the Temple Mount. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. So, I mean, I guess it could be Antiochus Epiphanes because he does die, and this guy dies, so maybe it's who it is, okay? These are reasons why it can't be Antiochus Epiphanes. You decide. Number one, it doesn't harmonize with his life. Antiochus Epiphanes did not exalt himself above every god. Antiochus Epiphanes did not reject his father's god. He did not worship an unknown god, and he did not come to his end in Israel, as it appears here. The reason this would be the ruler, okay, here's what I think, and you probably will too. This is, again, the traditional view. I'm going to quit with this. We'll pick it up next week. This is now talking about the Antichrist. The things that are said here about the Antichrist correlate with what Paul says about the Antichrist, what John says about the Antichrist, what Jesus says about the Antichrist in the time of the end. And this is about the time of the end. In fact, if you look in chapter 12, verse 1, at that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There'll be a time of distress such as that has never not happened from the beginning of nations until then. Now remember right there when I talk about in Thessalonians where it says that the command at the trumpet call and the voice of the archangel of him returning, it says at that time Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. I mean at the beginning, and it says, and there will be a time of distress, the seven-year tribulation, such as not happened from the beginning of nations. So where does Paul get the idea that when the Lord returns with the command and the trumpet, that the archangel Michael also shows up with his voice? Why is that? Well, right here. If he's talking about us meeting the Lord in the air, the rapture, and Michael returning for the 7 years of tribulation, that's what it says right here. At that time, before the 7 years, or before, it doesn't say 7 years, but before the time of distress such as not happened from the beginning of nations until then, which is, again, would be the tribulation. But at that time, your people, everyone whose names is found written in the book of life will continue. We'll have to pick that up next week, but I think we're talking there now. All of a sudden, we are now talking about the Antichrist and the things that will take place with his appearance. And we'll have to kind of break that down. What is missing then would be the 2,000-year, the 2,000-year period of time, which we call the church age, which is not amazing. People will mock at that who don't like the idea. But the idea there is the church age was a mystery. It was not revealed. They did not know about it. It was a mystery. Even Paul had to explain it to the disciples themselves. We are in the church age. So anyway, we'll talk about that and maybe some other things. If you got any questions or something, feel free to share them or send me an email or something like that if you want to, and maybe I might read it. I don't know. I get busy. But hey, thank you so much for being here. Father, we do thank you so much for your word. We thank you for the chance to study these things. We ask that we may find this as a source of direction and encouragement. We do ask that the seeds that we're planting with the word would be fruitful in our lives and in the lives of others. We do ask for truth, not just my teaching and my ideas, but for the truth of your pure word. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Hey, thank you for being here. Thanks for coming.